Okay, sorry there aren't enough handouts from last week. There are new handouts, but we'll wait till we get over, till we get up to the new questions. So let's just review a little bit. We had 8 questions presented from real life situations that were the reference points of last week's shiur. And maybe what we should do, just to start off this week's Chabura, is to look at the 8 questions. I'll say them out loud and see how many of them we've answered based on the learning that we've done thus far in the sugya of Bezdin jurisdiction. So the first question presented was Reuven, a Jewish business owner, enters into a lucrative contract with a major supplier, Stephen, who's also Jewish, but the other party insists on putting into their contract that in the event of a dispute, the matter will be litigated in the secular courts. Is it permissible for Reuven to enter into the contract with... Right, so the answer was based on the Maharshal, that there's no Isser involved. As we pointed out, that there's only when it comes into entering into a Ribbis transaction, there's an Isser Ketitza. There is a prohibition in entering into the contract itself. When it comes to going to secular courts, there's only an Isser Totsah, only in a prohibition of actualizing the prohibition of going to the secular courts, but stipulating that one is going to go to the secular courts is not itself prohibited because it could be interpreted, as the Rosh said, to mean that you'll go to the secular courts in the event that the other party refuses to go to Bezdin, in which case it would be permissible. Here we know that the other party is refusing to go to Bezdin because they're insisting that such a clause be inserted into the contract. And we said further, the Maharshal and the Yavshel Shlomo says that the contract does gain one advantage for the person who enters into it, namely that even though the Ramban writes that one is not allowed to expressly stipulate that they're going to go to secular courts and then avoid the prohibition in that fashion, because there's still a prohibition to go to the secular courts, in the event that it's known that the other party will refuse to go to Bezdin because they entered into a contract of this sort, then one doesn't even have to receive the Reshus Bezdin. They don't even have to go through the step of receiving explicit permission from the Bezdin to go to the secular court. That's what the Maharshal says. So in that sense, Reuven can bypass the heter of going to the Bezdin in the event that he ever will need to litigate a dispute with the other business partner with whom he enters into this contract. The second question we didn't cover yet. A shul enters into a contract with the rabbi, but the board wants to insert a clause that states that in the event of a dispute between the rabbi and the shul, that the dispute shall be decided by a non-Jewish arbitrator. Is this acceptable? Based on what we spoke about last week, would that be acceptable? They're not saying, stipulating, that the dispute, if there would be a dispute between the rabbi and the shul, they would have to go to a secular court, but they're also not stipulating that it should be decided by Bezdin. They're saying it should go in front of an arbitrator. Is that a non-Jewish arbitrator? Is that all right?
It also didn't say you have to follow American law either.
It doesn't say it has to follow secular law. Presumably, the arbitrator would be allowed to follow Hayashav Yato, equitable principles according to the arbitrator's sense of fairness and justice. So would that be okay? What? Lo Bnei Hadiotos means that in the event that you're going to set up a Bezdin, you shouldn't set up a Bezdin with people who don't know what they're doing if you have an alternative, right? And the Rashba said that in the event that nobody in the city really is learning, so then you can set up our Kol Shevisuya, you establish a Jewish court made up of people who just try their best to adjudicate the cases according to their best judgment. That's the idea of Lo Lifnei Hadyotis, that if you have a choice, that you have Mumchen and you're setting up a Bezdin, you should set up a Bezdin of qualified Dayanim. They should be people who have Yad and Yad and Smicha, right? But if you're going to go into arbitrator, let's say the Minog, that the custom of the city is that everybody in a certain type of industry submits their disputes in front of the arbitration board of that industry, like the Diamond Merchants Arbitration Association. So then the Rabbi Kiva Eger quoted the Maharshal as saying that there's no problem with that. On the other hand, it would be expected that if you're dealing with a shul, so a shul, the people who are entrusted to run a shul would presumably they're entrusted like the Zion Tuve Yair, like the elders of the city. They're entrusted to do everything in accordance with Jewish law. And therefore, the board members of the shul have a higher fiduciary duty towards halacha, so to speak, than people who are just entering into a regular business contract. So if you're a diamond dealer, to enter into a business contract that says that if we have a dispute, then we're going to submit the dispute in in front of the Diamond Dealers Arbitration Association is one thing, but if you're the board of a shul, and the shul is supposed to only be run according to the loftiest halakhic principles, you know, this is, after all, an exalted rabbinic spiritual institution, so then it might be on a very different level. So there's a tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein, which Rav Moshe Feinstein writes about the grounds for firing the menahel of a yeshiva, somebody who is a dean of a yeshiva, and whether there are sufficient grounds or aren't sufficient grounds. So he notes that according to halacha, a person should not generally be removed from a position of authority unless they have really transgressed some terrible, gross standard of behavior. However, in the event that the person is essentially doing their job, then the halacha says that you keep somebody at their position, provided that they haven't committed any wrongdoing. So the question was, what if it's stipulated in the contract that the yeshiva will have the right to remove this individual after a stipulated number of years? Let's say that's stipulated, that, you know, they can decide that for no cause whatsoever, they're just going to not renew the contract. So do they have the right to do so? So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, well, if you're dealing with a yeshiva institution or a shul institution, presumably it's understood that the people who are in charge of the institution are only entrusted by the public. They're only appointed to the board of that such an institution to do everything according to halacha. So therefore, if the strict halacha would not allow the removal of this person from his position, so then they have no right to do it. So Rabbi J. David Bleich says that the same would be true if you're dealing with like a shul contract. If you're dealing with a shul contract, even if normally it would be acceptable for two business people to just have a contract that submits their disputes to an arbitration board that's not arkos, it's not a secular court, and the arbitration board is not going to decide according to secular law, so you don't have that problem either. So it's not considered to be a repudiation of Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu. Nonetheless, when you're dealing with a shul, it's a different standard that has to be employed by a religious institution, that they should make sure to carry out all of their affairs solely in accordance with halacha. So when I was asked sort of the identical question to the business question by a rabbi called me up and said that the board of my shul does not want to enter into a contract that says that in the event that there's a dispute, this was his rabbinic contract, that we'll go to a Beis Din, because they're afraid that the Beis Din will always rule in favor of the rabbi, and they're afraid that the odds will be stacked against him, so they don't want to enter into such a clause. Would he have the right to enter into a clause with them if they insisted that the contract would say, if there's ever a dispute, then the dispute will be resolved according to secular court? So while there is no prohibition against entering into that contract in a business context, because there's no prohibition of stipulating such in the event that there would be a heter down the road, nonetheless, when dealing with a rabbinic contract, I said it's a different story. They're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to insist upon that. And I would say that there's an argument to be made, according to Rabbi Bleich, that they can't even insist upon just going to a secular arbitrator, that if it's a shul, then they really are duty-bound to just follow the dictates of halacha. And the dictates of halacha would indicate that the proper forum for adjudication in the event that there would ever be a dispute should be Beis Din, as opposed to some non-Jewish arbitrator who's not going to be bound by the standards of the Torah and the standards of halacha. So therefore, that would be in a totally different category.
But
yes?
Wars is wars. You know, sometimes Rabbanim end up in communities where the board is not that focused on halacha.
That's right, and the rabbi has to put his foot down. That's why the Gemara in Ksuva says that any rabbi who is, you know, beloved by everybody is not doing his job. That's the Gemara in Ksuva, right? Something like that says that any rabbi that when he starts off in his job, if everybody is fond of him, it means he's not putting his foot down.
Yeah, the Gemara says that arbitration is always preferable to a Beis Din.
Arbitration is a different story.
That was one of the issues here.
You see, there's arbitration means you're litigating the case and you are presenting it in front of a tribunal that is going to issue a decision against the will of the parties. That's arbitration. The difference between arbitration and litigation is that litigation means you're going in front of a court of established jurisdiction. There's an automatic court where you live, usually in our community, then where we live, right, in this country. That would be the secular court system. The secular court system is litigation because that's the established court of competent jurisdiction where we live. Okay? That's litigation. Arbitration means that you say, I'm not going to be subject, the two parties agree, they're not going to be subject to the official court of established jurisdiction. They're going to accept a different arbitration tribunal upon themselves. A Besdin, for example, functions as a tribunal that is an arbitration tribunal because the parties have voluntarily accepted it upon themselves as what? As a court to issue a binding decision. When you say arbitration is preferable, that's not exactly the word that we would use in halacha. What we say in halacha is that mediation is preferable. Mediation is always preferable. Mediation means that the parties are going to try to work things out with themselves. That's perfectly fine. The parties say, we're not going to litigate at all. We're going to try to work out a settlement between ourselves. We may even bring in a third party that's going to steer us towards an amicable resolution between ourselves. That's what we mean when we speak about pshara. Right. The parties doing a pshara between themselves means a pshara that they both agree to by themselves. So, of course, that's preferable. If the contract says the parties agree to mediation, that's not a problem. The thing with mediation is that mediation doesn't always yield a resolution. What happens if the parties try to mediate, but they're not able to reach a resolution? They're not able to reach a resolution, then they have to litigate. If they're going to litigate, so it's a prohibition against litigating in front of a secular court. What if they choose arbitration, that they say, okay, we'll go in front of a different fact finder, a different type of judicial body that's not the civil court, but is some other individual or a tribunal of arbitrators that we're going to accept upon ourselves. So we say in halacha, that's permissible so long as the arbitrators are not duty-bound to follow secular law. But what Rabbi Bleich is arguing is that if you're dealing with like a shul-type institution, so even that type of arbitration is improper. Once you're going to have a decision made that's going to be binding upon the parties, that should be done, if it's a shul institution, it should be done strictly in accordance with halakha, and therefore should only be a bezdin. Okay, now.
Is there a standard contract for shul rabbis in theory?
There is a proposed, I think, standard shul contract that was formulated by the Rabbinical Council of America, and I believe that it does have an arbitration provision that says in the event of any dispute, the parties agree that they'll submit to whatever is the official bezdin of the Rabbinical Council of America, like the Bezdin of America, or it has some sort of a zabla mechanism. What's a zabla? A zabla is where the parties don't necessarily agree on an official standing institutional bezdin, but they say that each party will choose one dayan, will choose one judge, one rabbi, and those, and then the two rabbis who are chosen by the two respective parties will pick a third rabbi. That's called Zeb Borer Lo Echad, which, and the acronym for that is Zabla, right? There's a perek in Masechet Sanhedrin, which is devoted to this idea of Zabla. Some of the hardest, most vexing questions that I get, you know, in my role in Bezdin is, when is a party duty-bound to submit to a Zabla? Because not all Zablas are equal. Some Zablas have the appearance of being contrary to halacha. What are the pitfalls of Zablas? That a judge is not supposed to be partial to a party that chose that judge. There has to be the possibility that the judge who was selected might rule against the party who selected the judge. But what happens in most Zabla proceedings is that the judges, I wouldn't say, are in the pocket of the party that provided them because we're on tape. But we don't find that, as a general rule, when Zabla proceedings take place, that the judge who is selected by one side will ever rule against that side. I have sat on Zabla cases, and I have ruled against the side who selected me, which is why I don't generally get selected as a Zabla judge. But that's the way that it's supposed to function. So there's a famous Rosh in Perek Zeb Bora Lo Echad, in Perek Zabla, in Masechet Sanhedrin, where the Rosh says that this is a major problem with Zablas, that people make the mistake of thinking that the judges are supposed to be biased in favor of the party that selected them, and that's not proper. It is proper that the party that selected the judge should have an expectation that if there is any argument that could be made in that party's favor, that the judge that that party selected will certainly think of that argument. But it doesn't mean that the party will necessarily have to rule in favor of that party. So that's one problem with what happens often with the Zabla proceedings. The second problem is that when it comes to Zabla proceedings, often you will have ex parte communications taking place between the party who selected a particular judge and that judge. And in a Besdin proceeding, there's never supposed to be, just like in any court proceeding, there's never supposed to be ex parte communications between any of the parties and any of the judges. But because the judges view themselves and are viewed as advocates, so therefore they often have no compunction about engaging these ex parte proceedings. So the Aruch HaShulchan writes that already in his day this was taking place, and he said it's not a problem so much because everybody knows that this is what goes on, so therefore there's an implicit mechila, there's an implicit waiver that everybody knows that each other party will be speaking to their borer, to the judge that they selected, and therefore, since there's a waiver, anything, you know, any right can be waived. However, what's implicit within the Aruch HaShulchan is that if a party says, I don't want to waive this, I feel that it should be a completely objective and impartial panel, so then a party has the right to do that. So often that's the case when I'm sitting on a Beis Din case and the parties can't agree upon a Beis Din. Why wouldn't they be able to agree on a Beis Din? Because they're having a fight and a dispute anyway. So why should they agree upon anything? That's why when parties enter into a contract, that's the best time to select a Beis Din, because that's when the parties are in agreement. They're first entering into the contract. So if the contract stipulates if there's a dispute, they'll go to a particular Beis Din. So then they're in much better shape than if they're going to first select a Beis Din at the time that they actually have their dispute. So if two parties can't agree upon a Beis Din, what will end up happening is that the case will be converted into a Zabla proceeding, where each party will choose a judge, and then the two judges will pick a third judge. So what happens if I'm sending out a summons in a case, and the defendant says, I don't want to go to your Beis Din, I want to go to a different Beis Din. And the plaintiff who came to us says, I don't want to go to that Beis Din, I want to go to your Beis Din. So then it becomes a Zabla. So let's say the defendant then picks a borer, picks a judge, who we know is generally a rabbinic advocate, and because you have individuals like this. You know, the rabbinic advocates who are like lawyers that appear in front of Beis Din. And what they do for their livelihood is that half of the cases, they're rabbinic advocates, they're the rabbinic lawyers, and the other half of the cases, they're a tohanim. They're the judges who get selected for Zabla proceedings. It's like, you know, one is just the other coin of the other side of the coin. It's basically the same role, but in a slightly different capacity. But they're essentially serving as an advocate. And then if the party that turns to our Beis Din says, I don't want to appear in a Zabla proceeding where the rabbis who are selected to represent each party are essentially advocates for that party, so we will say, you're not obligated to do so. Halakha does not compel you to appear in this type of a Zabla proceeding. And therefore, we will say in such a case, if you don't want to appear in front of such a Zabla proceeding, you have the right to go to secular court. And actually, this is a point of contention between Bati Din, in which I have served, and a lot of other Bati Din that are out there, that say, but this is what everybody does, so how can you, you know, tell somebody that they don't have to submit this type of proceeding? I feel that's not a sanctification of God's name. As we pointed out, the whole purpose, that's what Rashi and the Rama, I'm talking about Rashi in particular, talking about the whole purpose of Beis Din is that it's supposed to be a sanctification of God's name as opposed to a desecration of Hashem's name when you're going to another court system. So if the way in which the Beis Din is convened will itself end up being a desecration of Hashem's name, so then you're not accomplishing anything. So that's the argument that we'll make. The third problem with many Zabla proceedings is that there are a number of Zabla proceedings where there's money which is paid on the side to the advocate who is selected. And we know that you're not allowed, a party is not allowed to separately pay a dayan who was selected. That's called shochad. It's called, you know, bribery, which is, you know, another, you know, major problem. So therefore, since there are these three different issues that crop up, Zabla is these days a very prevalent proceedings. I mean, I'll just mention on the side that what I tried to do when I was in New York, what I tried to do was, instead of these cases where the parties couldn't agree on a Beis Din and being thrown to the Zabla wolves, what I would try to do is just say, look, if the parties start off saying that they're prepared to go to a legitimate Beis Din, you have Reuven is prepared to go to, say, Beis Din of America. Shimon is prepared to go to, say, Beis Din of Machon L'Hayra, which is a Yeshivish Hasidish, you know, Beis Din, which is in Muncie, New York, and Brooklyn. So instead of the two Bati Din saying, well, they can't agree on a Beis Din, so let's just throw it to the Zabla wolves, and, you know, each person will choose an advocate, and then the two advocates, you know, will sit with a party, you know, will choose an objective dayan who's really the only one who's going to have a vote, you know, an objective vote in the case, have the two Bati Din assign standing dayanim from their Beis Din, who don't know any of either one of the parties per se, because they're, you know, established dayanim who are presumably guided by the principles that are required for one to serve as a dayan. And then those two dayanim from the two different Bati Din will choose a third dayan from another standing accepted Beis Din. And for a long time, this is what we did. If you had a party who wanted Beis Din of America and a party who wanted Machon L'Ayra, Beis Din of America would appoint a dayan, Machon L'Ayra would appoint a dayan, and then the two of them would pick, let's say, a dayan from another Beis Din, Kol HaRabbanim. And we did this with Machon L'Ayra, we did it with Igud HaRabbanim, we did it with Beis Din Beis Yosef, we did it with I think the Beis Din, the Bat Rabbanim of Queens, with a number of different Batei Din, we were able to do this. I remember meeting once with the Carlsberg Beis Din. The Carlsberg Beis Din is from the Debrett Zina Hasidim, and I sat down with the Debrett Zina Rebbe, because we had a couple of cases where the Debrett Zina Rebbe, where there were where one party wanted to go to Beis Din America, another party wanted to go to the Carlsberg Beis Din. You say they're sort of like very, you know, distant, hashkafically, arguably, because the Beis Din America was more in the RCAOU, Yeshiva University world, and the Carlsberg Beis Din was more like the Satmar world, you know, which, not necessarily exactly on the same page, you know, in all respects. Often what would happen is that these were divorce cases, and the wives would want to come to the Beis Din of America, and the husbands would want to go to the Carlsberg Beis Din, because they felt, everybody went where they felt that, you know, they would get a better deal in terms of their own position. So I said to the Debrett Zina Rebbe, why don't we do the same thing we've been doing with other Batei Din? And when this happens, the Beis Din America will appoint a dayan, you'll appoint a dayan from your Beis, and then those two dayanim will appoint a third dayan. This way we'll have a more objective Beis, and then we won't have to worry about there being two out of three dayanim who are joined in a particular direction. So he said, in theory, he's completely in agreement. The problem is that from what he understands, all the dayanim of the Beis Din of America attended college, and therefore they're puzzled to be dayanim. So therefore, he was, you know, kind of stuck in a quandary that he couldn't necessarily work with the Yarnum of the Beis Din. So I said, well, maybe it's better, it's like the lesser of two evils, rather than having, like, you know, gangsters who are taking money on the side and, you know, advocating for a particular party, engaging next party communications. Maybe, you know, this is a better way to go. So he said, yeah, but, you know, his holy father, Zichrono Levracha, didn't have, you know, good opinions about, you know, people who went to college, so he had to be respectful to his father. So you could see, you know, some of the vagaries of what comes about if you don't have a clearly articulated a choice of Beis Din from the very beginning of a relationship, which is why this is something that is very strongly encouraged. Okay, let's look at question number three.
The case of the Riverdale Shul, that they wanted to terminate the contract of the rabbi. How did that finally play out?
I don't know. I don't want to speak about the cases where the actual names are mentioned, you know, per se, because I think this is all, you know, on tape or whatever. But I don't necessarily know the answer to that particular question. However, what has happened in a number of cases is that when there have been disputes between rabbis and shuls, is that they built into the contract was if there is a dispute, then the parties agree that they'll go in front of, say, the Beis Din of America, and then the cases would be presented in front of us. And I've had cases here in Chicago where there were contracts that said, in shul contracts, it said that in the event that there's a dispute, they'll go in front of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, and where one party didn't want to go in front of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, they wanted to go to court, so they wanted to try out a different Beis Din because they thought a different Beis Din might have an orientation that would be more advantageous to their position, and therefore we authorized the party that wanted to utilize our Beis Din. We said, since you have a contract that says that you're going to use our Beis Din, you can go to civil court and you can enforce that contract to require the other party to come in front of our Beis Din. Because the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Chavav says that normally it's considered to be a Chilul Hashem even to utilize civil courts to force somebody to come to Beis Din. When is it not a Chilul Hashem? When the Beis Din gives authorization. So if we gave authorization, it's not a Chilul Hashem. So we would give authorization, and we had cases where the court said, yeah, there's a clear contract that says that you have to go in front of the Beis Din of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, and then the parties were compelled to come in front of our Beis Din, and we adjudicated the case. So we had, you know, we've had situations like that.
How common is it in civil court that do they know of the Beis Din? Is it a common thing?
Yeah, they know of the Beis Din because there have been many, many cases that have been litigated in front of Batei Din, in front of rabbinical courts over the decades, particularly in communities where there are large populations of Jews. There's a tremendous amount of case law, not surprisingly, in New York. There were many, many cases in New York. In New York, the courts know all about, not only do the courts know about Beis Din, but the courts will actively refer cases to the Beis Din in New York. I mean, there were frum judges in New York who, if they would see two frum, you know, Haimish parties in front of them, they'd say to them, what are you doing in front of us? You know, go to the Beis Din. I had cases that came to that way. Because the judges told the parties to get out of the court and go to Beis Din, where they belong. So that sort of thing happens in New York.
In
Brooklyn, that sort of thing happens all the time. But in Chicago as well, there's less case law, but there's a certain amount of case law as well. So the judges are familiar with the concept of Beis Din. It is, you know, something, there's enough precedent, there's enough case law out there that it is, you know, familiar to, at least in places where there are large Jewish populations.
Maisa Bezdin is so cold, right? Isn't there a rule?
Maisa Bezdin has a call.
Has a call, so when you say it's confidential, I mean, are these cases, like, sealed, or are they confidential? Or are Maisa Bezdin supposed to be publicized?
Whenever a party, yeah, well, we get into a lot of trouble. Whenever parties submit to any arbitration tribunal, so the expectation is that everything is going to be closed and everything is going to be confidential. That's not necessarily the way that Bezdin would work as a matter of course. But once you're working within an arbitration system, so the Medrash Tanhuma says, Shoftim Shotrim Titen Lecha B'chol She'arecha. Imein Shotrim, Ein Shoftim. That you need officers and you need the government to enforce the decision of the Bezdin. So if you're living in a secular country where the Jews are not in charge of the government, so you need the governmental courts to enforce the Bezdin decision. So you have to comply with the procedural requirements of arbitration law so that the decisions of the Bezdin will be enforceable as arbitration decisions. Then they're just as enforceable as any decision which is issued by a court of competent jurisdiction. So I've had cases where they were, but because they, what gives no, but what gives the Bat Zedin authority is through acting as courts of arbitration. Arbitration is litigation, just not in front of a regular court. That's what arbitration
divorce,
is.
For example,
a divorce is not arbitration unless the parties have a dispute and they submit, like they have a monetary dispute related to the divorce, and they submit that dispute in front of the Bezdin. Otherwise, it's not
like a Gittins.
No. Gittin is not litigation. It's not arbitration. It's just a religious ritual. It's a religious ritual
in front of a
Bezdin. Just like a Gerus is not a conversion. It's not litigation. It's just a religious ritual. Chalitza is a religious ritual that takes place in front of a rabbinical court. But if there's a dispute between two parties and it's decided by the Bezdin, so that is arbitration. So therefore, part of arbitration is that the arbitrators have to keep cases confidential, which is a big problem in part because in order to encourage people to use the rabbinical courts, you want them to be able to see the decisions that have been issued so they can see how thorough and how thoughtful and how pragmatic the decisions of the Bezdin are, so that the parties, lawyers, you know, people in the business world will be comfortable utilizing the services of the Bezdin. What we've tried to do over the years is to publish the decisions in anonymized, redacted form. We take out the names of the parties and change the facts a little bit, but even then, it's a small enough community that people might recognize themselves and each other in the decisions. So what we'll do is we'll redact the decisions and take out the parties' names, and then we'll send the redacted decision to the parties of a case. And remember, usually there's one party that's a little bit more hospitable to the Bezdin than the other party, you know, whenever we issue a decision, right? And then we'll ask for written permission from the two parties for us to publish the case in its anonymized, redacted form. And we published maybe 12, 13, 14 decisions in this fashion over the years. And we're trying to publish more, but that's the only way that you can really publish it. It's not automatic. You know, it used to be when a get was done, for example, it was done in the public square so that everybody would know that a particular woman was divorced. But you know, the Bate Din have gotten into a lot of trouble by divulging information about a person who came in for a get. I had a case once where there was a woman who had received the get from the Bezdin, and she didn't want to reveal any information regarding her personal life and regarding her past marriage to any of her children. And she had a daughter who was born from a subsequent marriage. And this woman was not observant at all. And she didn't believe in observing. She didn't believe in being religious. And the daughter grew up, and the daughter became a Baalei Teshuva. And the daughter got worried, as many Baalei Teshuva get worried. Oh, my mother was previously married before she married my father. Maybe she didn't receive again, and therefore maybe I'm a Mezeris, and I can't, you know, date, and I can't, you know, marry anybody, you know, within the Jewish community unless, you know, they're a ger, or, you know, there's a special, you know, exceptional case. So the woman turned to the Bezdin and said, by any chance, did my mother receive a get from your Bezdin? Because she wanted to know if she was permissible for her to be married. So we said, why don't you just ask your mother? So she said, my mother doesn't want to tell me. My mother feels that all of her information is confidential. She, you know, fiercely guards the confidentiality. She feels it's none of my business. And she doesn't believe in all this religious mumbo-jumbo anyway. She doesn't think I need to be worried about whether I'm a mamzeris or not. So we were really in a bind, because if we would divulge the information that it's confidential regarding the mother's get, because the mother had an expectation when she came to the Bezdin of confidentiality, and if we would divulge that information, then that could become scandalous. Besides, you know, being sued, the mother might, you know, tell all of her friends, don't ever go to this Bezdin, and don't ever go for a get, and, you know, you should never go for gittin, because these rabbis, they can't be trusted. You know, rabbis are always blabbering, you know, secrets, you know, this is what rabbis do, that you can't trust them to keep a confidence, and therefore you should should never patronize or never encourage anyone to patronize the Beis Din. So we were really, really in a bind. But for then, I had this incredible epiphany, which is that all that this woman needed to know was that she's not a mamzeret. I don't have to divulge any personal information. So we said to the woman, we're going to write you a letter, you know, saying that we've done investigation according to Jewish law, and we've come to the determination according to Jewish law, you're not a mamzeret, and you're permitted to remarry. Not to divulge anything per se. But you have to come up with those types of creative solutions, that while at the same time not violating anybody's confidentiality. Because Bat Yitzin have gotten into trouble for, you know, just revealing information, which, again, if you're coming from the sensitivity or sensibility of the European autonomous Jewish communities, where it was just understood, Beis Din was a regular court, and, you know, certain things would be publicized, so then it's a different story. But if you're operating within the framework of an arbitration court where there are certain expectations when parties come to you, so you have to be sensitive and careful about honoring those expectations. Okay,
there's a special category for a shul that they're, you know, a special right. category of people who it's are... Sort of devoted to halacha.
Yes, that's what Rabbi Bleich argues. But based on Rav Moshe, in this concept of Zion to Veyayim.
So can we assume that in this context the definition of a shul is just an Orthodox shul, since the other shuls are not so devoted to halacha anyway?
I guess so. I guess we're talking about shuls that are dedicated to Torah. However, you know, whatever shuls fall into that category, Orthodox, you know, shuls that are devoted to Torah. Let's leave out labels. All right, so now the third question. Shimon, a patient, suffers from a physical disability as a result of negligent medical care from Dr. Rofe. Can he take Dr. Rofe to civil court since his main collection will be against a non-Jewish insurance company? So we said yes, right? Because we pointed out that the insurance company is like a guarantor, like an Arif Kaplan, and if the non-Jewish insurance company wouldn't come to the Beis Din, then they had to take it to court. What if the insurance company is prepared to submit to Beis Din? That was the Tashbetz, who says if the non-Jewish entity is prepared to come to Beis Din, so then you have to adjudicate against them in Beis Din. What if Shimon wants to go to Beis Din and Dr. Rofe insist that the case be taken to civil court? What if the defendant says, let's go against my insurance company? So we pointed out that the defendant doesn't have the right to do that, right? Because it's not up to the defendant who the plaintiff decides to prosecute. The plaintiff can sue either the Arab, either the guarantor, or the direct party, right? Unless, we said, what was the one exception? Anybody remember? A certain type of Arab? Arab Shluf? Shluftutz, right. If it's an Arab Shluftutz, if it's a guarantor who the parties agree that the only course of action will be against the guarantor itself. And we said that's probably true in auto insurance cases and medical malpractice cases. But it's not true if it's if a yeshiva has employment-related insurance in the event that a employee of the yeshiva would ever have a claim against severance or unfair termination against the yeshiva. So you can't assume that a rebbe goes into a contract with the yeshiva thinking, oh, I'll only have the right of recourse against the insurance company and I'll have to go to civil court, when civil court there won't be the same grounds of relief that would exist in a Beis Din. Because, you know, a rebbe might say, I'm entitled to Chodesh Hashanah, 1 month for every, you know, year of learning. And you could bring that type of case in a civil court. It doesn't matter if you have an insurance company with deep pockets. The court's going to throw it out. See, we never heard of Chodesh Hashanah. Yeah, there's no such thing. Okay, fifth case. A boy riding his bike in a bungalow colony lands in a ditch on the owner's premises. And the boy's family wants to bring the owner of the bungalow colony to secular court based on the claim that rabbinical courts nowadays do not have jurisdiction over Niske Bor. Now, there's a Gemara in Baba Kama that says that nowadays, what gives rabbinical courts their jurisdiction? We don't have smuchin. We don't have rabbis who were anointed by Moshe Rabbeinu or by any of the rabbis who had received smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu and had transmitted that smicha from generation to generation. That was cut off in the days of the Amoraim. What we have nowadays, don't tell anybody, we have imitation smicha. It's imitation smicha. It's not like the real thing. But this imitation smicha, so how does it give us the right to serve as Jewish law judges? Shikosayos. The Tosa says it works. The Gemara says that how could the judges in Babel adjudicate cases when they didn't have smicha? So the Gemara says they're shikosayos. They're the agents of the real, authentic judges who live in Israel who have authentic smicha. So Tosa says, but nowadays we don't even have rabbis in Israel who have authentic smicha. So how can we adjudicate cases? So he says, well, we shikosayos the kamaika of Dinan. We are considered to be the agents, the temporal agents of the rabbis from a previous generation, from an earlier point in time. Just as you can have geographical agency, you can have temporal agency. And therefore, but they said that this agency only pertains to certain types of cases. It has to be cases which are very common. It has to be most of the shliach, the isbechasonkis, and where there's monetary loss to one of the parties. So there's a question, certain types of liabilities, like, for example, if a dog bites a person, so we say it's not common. It's not common. You might suffer medical bills, and you might, you know, suffer loss because a dog bites you, but it's not common for a dog to bite a man. For a man to bite a dog is considered common. But for a dog to bite a man, that's not considered to be common. Meaning for a human being to cause, you know, damage to other people's properties, that's considered to be common. But for a dog to bite a man, it's not considered to be common. So therefore, that's not included within Shlichusayu. So there's the question, certain types of damages are not considered to be so common. So the Shach raises the possibility that maybe it's not so common for a person to incur liability by virtue of falling into a pit, what we call a bore, falling into a pit or falling into a ditch that was dug by somebody. It's a machlokis. The Shvus Yaakov says that it is. The Shach says that it's not. So this individual made the argument. The plaintiff said, well, my son fell into a ditch in the bungalow colony's bungalow colony owner's property, and I feel that the Bezdin doesn't have jurisdiction with respect to ditch damage because it's not Shlichusayu. Therefore, I want to go to civil court. And the defendant said, nothing doing. And there was no insurance here. There was no insurance because I don't know whether the law was that the bungalow colony was supposed to have insurance. The bungalow colony owner did not carry insurance. So there was no argument to go to civil court because the real claim was against the insurance company. So the question was, did the plaintiff have an argument to say that when a particular claim, action does not fall within Shlichusayu, there's an automatic right to go to civil court? So there's a Sefer HaTrumos. Sefer HaTrumos is one of the Rishonim, quoted by the Beis Yosef in Siman Chavav, who says that nothing could be further from the truth. That's also considered to be a Chilul Hashem. That just because Bezdin doesn't have jurisdiction doesn't mean you have the right to go to civil court. It means that Bezdin will decide the case according to other principles. It won't be able to decide according to the strict letter of the law, but it can decide. It can say that, okay, we can't make you pay for the damage of falling into the ditch, but we can say that nobody will be allowed to give you an aliyah or invite you to their bar mitzvahs until you make the other person whole. There are other creative ways that the Bezdin can get around doing it. Or the Bezdin can say, we're going to authorize the plaintiff to be able to bring the case to civil court because we think that's the only way that they can get a just recovery. But it first has to go through the Bezdin. The Bezdin has to hear the case and decide what's going to be the best remedy. So that's what the Sefer Truma says. So I pointed out, it was interesting. The one who was making this argument was not the party. It was the rabbinic advocate. It was like a very learned man. A learned rabbi who's making this argument, but I pointed out it's against the Beis Yosef. You can't you always have to go through the Beis Din. What?
Why is that ditch different than all the slip and falls?
You know, it's not necessarily different from the slip and falls. The slip and falls, if the slip and falls take place because somebody created a dangerous condition on their, you know, in their property, so that might fall into the same, you know, category. It might be considered to be low shchiach. You'll say, oh, nowadays it's very shchiach. It's one of the most common cases. Slip and falls make up the majority of, you know, all the actions. So, okay, that was the argument. So Shvus Yaakov would agree with you. Okay, now the next case is what I want to discuss that we haven't really gotten into. Rachel and Yaakov sign a prenuptial agreement. They sign a prenuptial agreement. It says in the event of a marital breakup, they will submit any dispute to the Betin of the Chicago Rabbinical Council. Ah, okay, that's us, right? They'll submit any dispute to the Chicago Rabbinical Council. And however, Rachel wants Yaakov to agree to instruct the Betin to decide any monetary issues based on norms consistent with secular divorce law. She says that according to Jewish law, who knows, there are like all these concepts that I'm not so comfortable with, Mashakansi, Isha Kanabaila, that whatever money I make automatically goes to my husband, that everything belongs to the husband except for the assets that the wife brought into the marriage and the nedunya and the dowry. So she says, I don't like that system so much. I prefer equitable distribution. The way that things work according to secular law, the way that things work in the general society in which we live, in which if there would ever be a marital breakup, so the assets would be divided more or less evenly, what the courts call equitably. So I would want a Bezdin, I'm prepared to go to Bezdin, but only a Bezdin is going to decide the case according to those norms. So here's what we were discussing up until now. We said that the notion of going to court as opposed to Bezdin, so that's not even something that parties are allowed to do, even if they both stipulate, because that's considered to be masna mashakasa b'toyu b'doa shebi'asa. That's considered to be making a stipulation that is contrary to the ritual laws of the Torah. To desecrate God's name by stipulating that going to go to secular court would be like stipulating that going to violate Shabbos. You can't do that. You can't do that. But you are generally allowed to stipulate that you're going to agree upon certain monetary conditions. So are you allowed to stipulate, we'll go in front of the Bezdin, but the Bezdin is supposed to, well, we want the Bezdin to decide our case in accordance with secular law, because the secular law norms are the norms that we are the most comfortable with. Now, the Chazon Ish said, if you set up an entire court system made up of Jewish people, like they did in the state of Israel, right? You make up an entire court system made up of Jewish judges, but those Jewish judges are duty bound to follow a certain legal system which is contrary to Torah. Maybe it's made up of Ottoman law, maybe it's made up of British law, it's made up of Roman law. It's made up of a law of different cultures and societies other than Jewish law. So then the Chazon Ish says you can't do that either, because that's also considered to be Haramas Yabatoras Moshe Rabbeinu. It's also considered to be a slap in the face of the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's also a desecration of God's name. You can't do that either. But what if in an individual case, the parties appear in front of Bezdin, and they say, in this case, we want Bezdin to decide according to secular law. So would that be permissible? Would that not be permissible? So Rav Zalman Menachemya Goldberg, he's a great posek in Eretz Yisrael. He sat on the Beis Din of Gadol. He's the son-in-law of the late Shlomo Zalman Auerbach Zatzal. So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg advised the Beis Din of America maybe 20 years ago. Around 20 years ago. He said that it's very important you should encourage couples to sign prenuptial agreements that, number one, to avoid aguna situations, so that will say that the Beis Din is given jurisdiction over get matters. But he said there's a valid claim that lots of Talmidei Chachamim and husbands can have against entering into such a prenuptial agreement. They'll say, that's nice, I'm being forced to go in front of this Beis Din when it comes to get matters, but my wife is going to take me to the cleaners when it comes to monetary matters, because she'll take me to secular court, and that's against halacha. So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg said, you know, there's truth to that, Taina. Really, the prenuptial agreement should say that all matters, not just the get matter, all matters will be decided by Beis Din. But there's a problem, because many women are not going to be comfortable with that, because they'll say, the way that the Beis Din decides monetary matters does not meet my comfort level, because I'm more comfortable with the secular system. So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg said, no problem, so just stipulate in the prenuptial agreement that the Beis Din will decide any monetary disputes in accordance with secular law. So he thought that would be perfectly permissible. So Rav Tzvi Gartner, who's another big time Chacham, who lives in Eretz Yisrael, he wrote the book called Kfiya Beget. Kfiya Beget, it means coercion. When it comes to a get, when is coercion permitted, what's considered coercion, what's not considered to be coercion. So he wrote the book on the subject. He's a big, big Talmid Chacham. He just started a new Torah journal. What's it called? Tevunos? Something like that. He started a new Torah journal just a couple of months ago. So Tzvi Gartner wrote a letter. It's all published in the Torah journal called Yeshurun. He wrote a letter to Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg in which he said, what are you doing? Said that just like the Chazon Ish railed against the courts in Israel, even though they were made up of Jewish judges, because they were deciding all cases according to some secular legal system, so too, if parties stipulate they'll go to Beis Din, but they want the Beis Din to decide according to secular law, that should be equally problematic. So the Minchas Tzvi is a Dayan, I think he lives in Eretz Yisrael, his name is Tzvi Spitz. You may have come across some of his writings, because some of his writings were translated into English. It's like, you know, monetary cases according to Jewish law, or, you know, that it's a translation of some of his Hebrew Sfarim on Choshen Mishpat and Jewish law. So Tzvi Spitz said, well, you know, it really depends. That if the party, you know, parties are allowed, the Gemara in the Mishnah Baba Metzia talks about how a Shomachinim is allowed to stipulate. Well, even though the Torah says the Shomachinim is off the hook with this Gneva Vaveda, a Shomachinim can stipulate that he'll be Chayiv anyway for Gneva Vaveda. A Shomasacha can stipulate that even though the Torah says a Shomasacha is Chayiv Gneva Vaveda, he'll be off the hook for Gneva Vaveda. They're allowed to make these stipulations. So you don't have to follow the monetary scheme of Torah law if it's only a monetary matter. And then Beis Din will decide according to whatever deal was struck between the parties regarding liability or non-liability. So he said, you can do the same thing to say, I'm comfortable with a certain set of principles, and those set of principles happen to be consistent with secular. Let's say the two parties enter into a real estate contract in Eretz Yisrael, and they say, well, we want our real estate contract to be governed by the Chot Mikarkoin, to be governed by the real estate statute in Israel. So he said, if you're going to say it's going to be governed by the real estate statute in Israel, so that's a problem, because the real estate statute in Israel is a secular statute, and then you're accepting upon yourself the dictates of secular law. But let's say that instead of saying I'm accepting upon myself the real estate statute happens to have 45 different provisions, and you just write down those 45 different provisions. You don't say I'm accepting upon myself the Israeli law statute of real estate law. But you're just saying, I'm accepting upon myself the following 45 provisions. And you write those 45 provisions in the contract. So Street Smith says, this is a great way to get out of the problem. Because you're not accepting upon yourself a separate legal system. You're just accepting upon yourself certain principles of interaction, of monetary interaction between the parties that happen to be consistent with civil law. So Street Gardner said he thought that was a joke. And there was a joke. He said, what's the difference? One thing is exactly the same. What if you want to do, what's the difference? Whether you call it this or you call it that, it's exactly the same thing.
Uniform, so if you look at, you're going to copy the whole uniform.
Right, so that's what he suggested. That's what he suggested that you did, that you do. On the other hand, maybe he's on to something. If you take a look at Source Zion in the handouts, this is, again, we're finishing up the first handout today. We're not going to get to the second handout today. Okay. So the first is, so the Darkei Moshe quotes the Mordechai, who says, "Had the master mash custom with over Dorishim a moment to know Kayim." That which we say that you're allowed to make a stipulation with respect to monetary matters, Hanudaka Shamu Bederach Tanai. That's only if you're making a general condition among Motel Hafkia to know a Batel. But if your idea is that you're being Mafkia, you're actually repudiating the laws of the Torah, so that's much more problematic. That's much more problematic. So it seems like there might be a distinction between just accepting certain provisions on yourself and repudiating the laws of the Torah by accepting explicitly a legal system contrary to the Torah. This might have some relationship to the following machlokis that exists between the Mishnah Melech and the Ktzos. This is Source Ches. There's a Gemara. We just did it in Daf Yomi. The Gemara says, a person gets married, and he says to his wife, he says, "I am incadentiously, I'm marrying you." Oh, sounds very loving, right? He says, "Oh, one condition, you know, just one little, you know, caveat. I'm an ashein lachalai shirk susfeona. Then you can't demand from me that I'm going to give you food or clothing, or conjugal relations." So the Gemara says, just a slight wrinkle. So the Gemara says that this is binding if she agrees to it. It's binding with respect to the condition that he's not going to provide food or clothing, not binding with respect to the conjugal relations. That's not something that can be waived. It's sar shebegup. It's a physical matter. But when it comes to food and clothing, so if she agrees that she's going to waive her right to food and clothing, she can waive her right to food and clothing. What if he says that I want you that to waive your right to the law of food and clothing, not the food and clothing itself? I'm an ashein lachalai din sherek sus feona. So here, the Mishnah Melech says, that's going too far. That's going too far. If he's saying that that the entire law is not going to be applicable, so then he has no right to abrogate the laws of the Torah. He can waive, a particular right, but he has no right to abrogate the laws of the Torah. So Sechoshin says, what in the world is this based upon? Says it's based upon the following machlokas Rishonim. Says that the Rashba says, on what basis do we say that a person is allowed to make a tanai shem moment? They can make a monetary stipulation that is different from that which the Torah would have otherwise required. Says the Rashba says it's based on the law of Mechila, that a person is waiving rights that they otherwise would have had according to the Torah. That somebody who gives a bailment to a Shomer Sachar is waiving the right to be able to receive compensation in the event of Gneiva of Aveda, saying, I'm going to let you off the hook with respect to Gneiva of Aveda. I'm waiving my rights. Okay, a person has the right to waive the right. The Ramban in Baba Basra gives a different explanation. The Ramban in Baba Basra says, it's not a waiver per se. It's that chiyuvim of the Torah, the monetary obligations of the Torah, don't go into effect eliberitzono shosheni. They only go into effect if the party that would receive the benefit of those monetary rights wants to have those monetary rights. If he doesn't want to have those monetary rights, it's not the question that they exist and then they're going to be waived. They never kick in to begin with if the person says, I don't want them. I don't want the benefit of those monetary rights. So says the Ktzos, what's the practical difference between the understanding of the Rashba, that tanai shem moment works based on mechila, based on waiver, that the obligation exists but it's being waived, or whether you understand like the Ramban, that the obligation never even gets off the ground unless the person who would be the beneficiary of it says that I want the benefit of this obligation. It says it's exactly this case of what if the person, instead of saying Amanasha Ein Lachalai Sherek Sus Ve'ona, says Amanasha Ein Lachalai Din Sherek Sus Ve'ona, that I'm only marrying you on condition that this entire law will not be applicable. So according to the Rashba, you have no right to waive. Nobody can waive an actual law of the Torah. The law of the Torah is there. There's no ability to waive this. Like a person who, when it comes to making a loan before the Shemitah, before the end of the Shemitah, says, Amanas, the Gemara at the beginning of Makos, says, Amanas shol tishmeteni shvius. on condition that the Shemitah will not knock out the loan. You can't do that. You can't knock out the law of Shemitah. You can't knock out the law of Shemitah's Ksafim, that the loan is going to be canceled at the end of the 7th year of the Shemitah cycle. If you say, I'm a national Kishmetani Bishvius, that yes, the loan will be knocked out, but you know, between the two of us, you'll repay me anyway. So the Gemara says that's completely okay. Similarly, with respect to Onah, a person's not allowed to overcharge by more than 1/6 something that something is worth. So the Gemara draws the distinction. It says, if a person says, Amanas Shein Lach Alai Ona, that you don't have the right to make the claim of Ona against me if I overcharge you, that's considered to be enforceable, according to Shmuel. But if a person says Amanas Shein Bo Ona, that it's on condition that we're going to abrogate the law of Ona, so then that condition is not considered to be enforceable. So it's the same general principle. So you can't waive a law of the Torah. So that would be the explanation of the Mishnah Melech, who says that you can't make a condition, Amanashin Nachalai Din, Shirksus Ve'ona. But according to the Ramban, the din doesn't go into effect unless the beneficiary of the din wants it to go into effect. The wife who would be the beneficiary, Shirksus, says, no, it's okay, I'm not triggering that din. I don't want that din to go into effect with our marriage. I'm so desperate to get married that I love you so much, depending how you look at it, that I'm willing to marry you, even though you're not going to provide me with food or clothing. So therefore, says the Ksos, based on the understanding of the Ramban, one would be allowed to make this condition, Amanashein Lachalai Din Sheksus Ve'ona, and the Ksos says, he thinks that that's the correct opinion. So that's what the Ksos says, that's source number Ches over here. So according to the Ksos, maybe we can understand that would be sort of the same machlokus between the contemporary poskim, not that they're describing their vantage point quite in the same way, but it might conceptually explain these two different positions. Those who would take the position to say that, well, you can incorporate the provisions of the secular law, you just can't mention that it's a secular law, would say, because otherwise you're basically officially abrogating the laws of the Torah. You're saying, okay, I don't want the laws of the Torah to apply, I want secular law system to apply. According to those who say that you can incorporate it, so they'd be saying that, just like you could say, Shein Lachalai Din Sheksus Ona, the Torah laws, the monetary scheme of the Torah laws, don't go into effect unless the other partisan wants it. If they say, no, I'm happy with the monetary laws that exist within the secular sphere, so then it's perfectly legitimate to do that, because they're not abrogating anything, they're just not accepting upon themselves the Torah law. So it could be that we can, you know, understand the Melchokas in that way. I once wrote a mimer in which I made this argument. So I mentioned it to Rabbi Willig once. I said that, you know, I thought it was like Balabatish. He said, no, it sounds good. So, okay, so I figured I can mention it to you as well. So now at the core of all of these discussions is the Rashba. The Rashba wrote a tshuva. Okay, this is Chelek Bar Simon Reish Nandalet. It's the last, essentially the last source of the first set of materials. We have about 8 minutes to go through this. The Rashba was asked about a clause, or about a certain custom that existed in a particular city, where if a man would marry a woman, and the woman would bring in a dowry from her father, and then, Rahmana Litzlan, the woman would die without any children within the first year or two of marriage. So the custom was that the amount of the dowry would go back to her father. According to Jewish law, the dowry is a Yerusha that goes to the husband. So the question was whether they should just follow what the secular law was, so that it would go back to the father, or follow the laws of the Torah, that it should go to the husband. So the Rashba...
Was this Poland?
This was Spain. So the Rashba gives a very strange answer. Okay, if you turn to the page 4, for those of you who have the handout, and look at what's in the bold. So he starts out Tshuva. Okay, what?
France. It's Perpignan is in France, isn't it?
The Rashba lived in Spain. So maybe he's referring to something that happened in France. That's possible. That is possible. Okay, so the Rashba in the Tshuva says, number one, called Rashba Mamon Tano Kayim. You can make any condition you want. And not only that, he says, but even if this is the custom of where the people live, that they follow this rule, that the money would just go to the father upon the death or the demise of Rachman al-Tzlan, of the daughter at the beginning of the marriage, so then even if he didn't explicitly make a tanai, he didn't explicitly make such a condition, so it's just self-understood, that's perfectly fine. But then he says, next bold point, he says, but if you're going to stipulate this way because this is the law of the Gentiles, so that is prohibited, shemachakis the goyim, because you're doing it to imitate the goyim. She lohi nicha toras am shem lenachal lo tzorim shiayikus chukas goyim dinam, because God didn't give us the Torah that we should go and glorify another legal system. And how can you even allow for such a thing? Go back, go down to where we have the three dots. God forbid anybody should even think that way. You do away the laws of Yerusha. You're going to rip down the walls of the Torah. And you're going to uproot all of the foundations of the Torah. So he says, that's such a terrible thing. And then the Rashba goes on to say a third thing. The third thing that he says is, there's a principle called Dina de Malchusa Dina. The law of the land is the law. So the Rashba says, you can't argue that the law of the land will extend to all monetary matters, because the idea of Dina de Malchusa Dina means that you have to pay taxes, or that the government has the right of eminent domain, that they can take certain areas and build bridges and do things that are public works. But the notion that our monetary system of law is going to be supplanted by a different foreign system of law, so he says, that's not included within Dina de Malchusa. And then go back to the very end, the last bold point, the last two lines, with Darshim and Mammon, but if it's not just a monetary matter, truth of the matter is, you can stipulate however you want, just like a Shalmachinim can decide he'll be like a Shoal, a Shoal can decide it's going to be like a Shalmachinim, you can do whatever you want. So you look at this Tshuva with the Rashba and say, what is going on over here? The Rashba started out saying, you can make any Tanai you want, and even if you didn't make it explicitly, this is what everybody does, so of course you do it. Then he says, oh, but this is like the worst thing in the world, you're uprooting the Torah because you're doing it to imitate the Goyim. And then he says, and if you're going to do this based on Dina the Machus Dina, we may as well just throw out all of our Sfarim. Take a look at the end of the long paragraph over here. It says, and what do we need the Gemaras? What do we need the Mishnayos for? What do we need the Gemaras for? Just send all your kids to law school. Even the Bamos to Lewis, the basement say a guy, they all just build their voters, Zara churches. That you'll end up, the Torah will have to wear ashes and sackcloth, and you're just destroying everything. So, and then at the very end of the Tshuva, the Rashba says, and of course you can do whatever you want. So he starts off, you can do whatever you want, ends off, you can do whatever you want. In the middle, you're destroying the entire system of Torah. So what exactly is the Rashba really saying? And how do we incorporate this? So every single person who talks about this issue of whether you can stipulate in front of a Bezdin that the Bezdin will follow secular law, they all talk about this Rashba. All of the opponents to the notion of authorizing the Bezdin to decide according to secular law quote the Rashba, and the others qualify the Rashba. So I'd just like to quickly give you five different ways in which the Rashba is qualified. First of all, source Yud over here is the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch quotes the Rashba, but only quotes the Rashba to say, in other words, says, what's the holding of the Rashba? The holding of the Rashba is just that we don't automatically incorporate the provisions of secular law based on Dina de Malchusa. But that would seem to imply that if the parties both say that they want to make a Tanai, they want to make a condition to incorporate a certain provision of law, that would be okay. So maybe that's the way we paskin. That aspect of the Rashba, of Dina de Malchusa, that we say is true, that we don't extend the Dina de Malchusa to the entire monetary system of the nations around us, but the notion that we can't make it tonight, so that's not what we derive from the Rashba. Beis Yosef, a source, Yud Aleph, gives a different qualification. Says, you know what the Rashba was really talking about? Kasra Rashba, Shinishal Echa Shemesa Bito, Vitores Kasram Barkos Agoyim. That the entire case of the Rashba was only about whether or not you have the right to go to secular court. The Rashba doesn't seem to say that in the Tshuva. Doesn't seem to say it's talking about going to secular court, but that seems to be the way that the Beis Yosef understands Beis Yosef. It's a Shulchan Aruch. That seems to be the way that the Beis Yosef understands the Rashba. There are three other ways that you can qualify the Rashba as well. One is that maybe it's only a problem. What did the Rashba say? If you're doing it, lasos is that lachakos kidei lachakos is a goyim. If you're doing it to imitate the non-Jews, you're saying, I don't know what the secular law says. I have no idea what the secular legal system says. Maybe it says something that I like, maybe it says something I don't like, but I just feel they know what they're doing more than we know what we're doing. So that's a problem. But if you really studiously see what the set of laws say, and you say, you know, with respect to this type of transaction, this is the type of monetary scheme that I would like to apply to us, you're not doing it to imitate them, you're doing it because you feel, I want equitable distribution. You know, that's like the scheme that makes the most sense to me, and it happens to be consistent with secular law. That would be potentially okay. Okay, a fourth possibility is, what was the Rashba talking about? He was talking about uprooting the laws of Yusha, of inheritance. Inheritance, arguably, is within Jewish ritual law as opposed to Jewish monetary law. But if it's just a regular monetary case of a couple getting married, say that we want our assets divided according to equitable distribution, that would be perfectly fine. A fifth way of distinguishing the Rashba that I saw in the writings of Ezra Batsri is to say there's a difference between if the entire community says that we are never going to incorporate Torah law into the way that we decide our cases when it comes to, you know, inheritance and this type of situation, or whether you have each individual person make that determination for themselves. So if you have a particular couple that says, we want, we're not telling them that everybody has to decide this way, we're giving people the option. You can decide that you want the bezin to decide according to Jewish law, or you can decide that you want the bezin to decide according to equitable distribution law, so then that would be perfectly okay. So if you look at the way in which we have the prenuptial agreement that we promulgate on behalf of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, also the Beth Din of America, the way it's devised is that when couples get married, they have three options. They can say, the parties agree the Beth Din is authorized to decide all monetary disputes that arise between them according to the normal principles of adjudication of Jewish law and Pshara and so forth, or the parties agree that the Beth Din is authorized to decide all monetary disputes, including division of property and maintenance, that may arise between them based on principles of equitable distribution law customarily employed in the United States as found in the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act. Why do we use the words customarily employed? To show they're not doing it because they want to be mechakes agoyim, want to imitate the non-Jews, but because this is the custom. And this is the custom that they are familiar with and they are comfortable with. And we say that people always have the right to follow principles of custom and to incorporate that into contracts and to incorporate that into what is presented in front of the Beis Din. So therefore, on that basis, as long as the parties are not just seeking to imitate the secular court system or prefer the secular court system over the halakha, but just in an individual case, incorporate certain principles that based on their normal custom of dealing. So the feeling that we have is that this would be perfectly permissible according to halakha. Okay, stop here.
And the fourth, if it's ritual, yeah, not monetary, then it would be more of a problem.
If it be ritual, then it would be more common. For example, if you have parties that stipulate that they're going to agree to do business, b'dvarim asurim, they're going to make money out of selling pork. So even if they both stipulate to that, that's a ritual prohibition, so they wouldn't have the right to do that.
Okay. Rabbi Wein has a comment. Do you ever hear his comment on the rub that they want to throw out a shul?
Right. I'm not sure when we're meeting next time, whether we're meeting next Thursday night. I think our next meeting is two weeks from now. I think it's the next one. Okay.
Rabbi Wein said a rub that lets himself be thrown out isn't a man, and if he doesn't want them to throw him out, he's not a rub.
Uh-huh.
Are there other religious communities that have the equivalent of Beis Din?
Yes. In the Muslim community, they have Sharia law.
Right.
They do have a very developed legal system in the Muslim world. They don't seem to have as developed a legal system, from what I can tell, in the Christian world. But in the Muslim world, they have very, you know, complex and developed Sharia law, which in certain respects, certain aspects of Sharia law, like when it comes to prohibited interest, actually, you know, it shares certain resemblances with halakha. There's a lot of political backlash nowadays against Sharia law because of the fear that will lead to fundamentalism, things like that. But it's really in our interest that they uphold Sharia courts, that they'll also uphold Bati Din, as long as arbitration procedures are followed.
One of the ladies from the Mishnah class wanted to sit in on this class.
Rabbi Graham said that it's for men only.
So what? Do you object?
I don't object, but it's not, but I'm not in charge.
Who's in charge?
Yeah, but I ain't a boy, I'm a man, 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 I'm a I'm going to go back.